This is Functional Medicine Update for July 2000, Volume 19, Number 7. This month our area of exploration will be functional genomics. On Side 1 we begin with a report on functional somatic syndromes, followed by a look at genetic research in personalized applications. Other topics will include gene-by-environment interaction for passive smoking and glutathione, modification of genetic risk to breast cancer, antioxidants and cancer therapy, genetic factors in detoxification, osteoarthritis, and early assessment of cardiovascular risk. Our interview on Side 2 this month is with researcher Dr. Robert Sapolsky discussing the changing face of medicine in the 21st century. We conclude this issue with reports on inflammation and cardiovascular disease, folic acid in B6 for subclinical atherosclerosis, and cutting-edge research uses of functional analysis. Here is Dr. Jeffrey Bland and the July 2000 edition of Functional Medicine Update.
Functional medicine, functional somatic syndromes. What is it? Let's take a quick review once again according to what the Lancet tells us, volume 354, page 936, in a discussion on functional somatic disorders, one or many. As we all know, patients seek help from doctors for symptoms and doctors diagnose diseases to explain them. Symptoms are the patient's subjective experience of changes related to the severity, duration, and frequency in his or her body. Most patients don't seek out the care of a health provider just because they feel great, wake up in the morning and say, I think I'll go to my health care provider to find out why I feel so wonderful this morning. They basically come at some threshold of discomfort as seen as a subjective symptom of increasing duration, frequency, and severity that leads them to their practitioner's offices. Diseases are objectively observable abnormalities, obviously, in the body that are set as it relates to some standard. These are called ICD-9s in the parlance of today's language. However, this is a relative scale that has changed in time as our diagnostic procedures have become different. As you know, back in the 18th and 19th century, the diagnosis of what we now call diabetes was done by tasting the urine for the taste of sweet, a very simple physiochemical control system. As we have developed more sophisticated methodologies for analyzing aberrations in insulin and blood sugar control, obviously new technologies, including now the more recent finger stick technologies, have become available, giving us a different set of diagnostic lenses to evaluate what we call diabetes. But yet the condition, as Dr. Robert Sapolsky says, of feeling crummy has remained pretty much the same throughout all these many centuries. So feeling crumminess may stay the same, but the way we assess it, language it, and ultimately define it has changed relative to our perceptions. So diseases are objectively observable abnormalities in the body as contextualized at that time in history. Difficulties obviously arise when the doctor can find no objective changes to explain the patient's subjective experience of discomfort, of pain, severity, duration, and frequency. The symptoms are then often referred to as medically unexplained or functional, giving a negative spin to the word functional medicine. Many different functional syndromes have been described. In fact, each medical specialty seems to have at least one. For rheumatologists, prominent muscle pain and tenderness called fibromyalgia has often been called a functional disorder, indicating that it has a psychosomatic component. For gastroenterologists, abdominal pain with altered bowel habits called irritable bowel syndrome, or IBS, has traditionally been called a functional disorder, meaning, again, a lot of its origin is psychosomatic. And, of course, chronic fatigue, post-viral fatigue syndrome, has also been defined as a functional disorder. As we, however, in biomedical science have looked more deeply at the origin of these conditions, it's been found that what may have appeared on the surface to be, quote, functional, end quote, meaning psychosomatic, is really functional, meaning has a functional change in physiology that can be identified when we look at the right places and ask the right questions. In the article Functional Somatic Disorders, the authors postulate that the existence of specific somatic syndromes is largely an artifact of medical specialization. That is to say that the differentiation of specific functional syndromes reflects the tendency of specialists to focus on only those symptoms pertinent to their specialty, rather than any real symptoms and differences in those symptoms between patients that have organic relationships. In exploration of this hypothesis, the authors reviewed the research literature with regard to three questions. Number one, Does the published diagnostic criteria for each of the specific functional syndromes overlap in their constituent symptoms? Number two, do patients identified as having one functional somatic syndrome also meet symptom criteria for others? And lastly, three, are there similarities across syndromes in the non-symptom characteristics of gender coexisting emotional disorders, proposed etiology, prognosis, or response to treatment? As a consequence of that, it's a very interesting conclusion that they derive. Similarities are apparent in case definition, reported symptoms, and in non-symptom associations, such as the variabilities and demographics that I described. They conclude that the existing definitions of these syndromes in terms of specific symptoms is of limited value. Instead, they believe a dimensional classification related to functional characteristics at a physiological and functional physical level are more appropriate. And in fact, they go on to say that as a consequence of each medical specialty defining its own syndrome or syndromes in terms of its inability to understand physiochemical or biochemical mechanisms, that it has tended to put a negative stigma on the term functional within medicine. Well, clearly we're trying to use, in your functional medicine parlance, the term functional to refer to the early prognostic changes that occur at a level of cellular function that then aggregate over time with increasing duration, frequency, and severity until they finally become a tissue, organ system, and finally a whole body problem. And that these particular sequences of events that give rise to increasing severity are eventually seen as warning signs to take action, to do something. The body is out of balance. And some people get that warning sign and that early alert system at an early stage in their development of these symptoms. And other people, it takes a good hard hit around the head, maybe a coronary event that wakes them up, if not permanently puts them to sleep, to recognize where these functional disturbances are originating or where their locus of activity is. So when we start looking at functional medicine from our definition, which cuts across a diagnostic medicine and precedes diagnostic medicine, looking at the physiological and physical, cognitive, and emotional changes that occur prior to the onset of disease, it opens up a broader boundary of exploration for the clinician in evaluation of this feeling of crumminess that Dr. Sapolsky talks about. Now, you'll notice that I've referred to Dr. Sapolsky on two occasions already in this month's Functional Medicine Update, and that's in part because I've been so impressed with his book, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers, and his other book, The Trouble with Testosterone, but also because we're very fortunate to have him this month as our researcher of the month, the Stanford University professor, who I think will share with you on side two of this month's Functional Medicine Update some extraordinary visionary concepts, some insights, some perspective, and some guidance as to, I think, where medicine may in fact be traveling over the next decade. Going back to our discussion of function, let me, if I can, revisit something that we had discussed several issues ago of Functional Medicine Update, and that's the New England Journal of Medicine report, volume 339, page 1013 in 1998, comparison of chiropractic manipulation as an adjunctive treatment for children who have asthma. In the evaluation of this work, I think I really did the investigators some discredit that I want to go back and make good on. The principal investigator, Dr. Jeffrey Balin, is a medical doctor and a chiropractic physician who I have known personally for a number of years. This is really excellent study in that the attempt was made to really try to understand, using a metric evaluation, the effect that chiropractic manipulation had in reduction of symptoms in childhood asthma versus, say, more traditional medical intervention. And in this report, this was 80 children, you might recall, 38 in the active treatment group and 42 in the simulated treatment group. They had outcome data that was evaluated. There were small increases, 7 to 12 liters per minute in peak expiratory flow in the morning and evening in both treatment groups. That's the group that got chiropractic treatment versus those that did not, with no significant differences between the groups in the degree of change from baseline. Symptoms of asthma and the use of beta agonists decreased and the quality of life increased in both groups with no significant differences between the groups. There were no significant changes in spirometric measurements or airway responsiveness between either the children that got the active chiropractic treatment or the simulated treatment group that did not get the appropriate treatment. They then come to the conclusion that in children with mild to moderate asthma, the addition of chiropractic spinal manipulation to usual medical care provided no benefit. And I criticized that conclusion by saying it didn't seem to derive fully from the data of their study nor the inference of that data. I'd like to go back and say that using straight statistical normative evaluation, that their conclusion that there is no benefit of chiropractic manipulation of the spine in children with mild to moderate asthma does stand the test of that evaluation. What does seem, however, to emerge from this is the recognition that doing something, laying on of hands, being present with the patient, having some relationship to that patient, which was seen in both the what is called simulated treatment group and the active chiropractic treatment group, had positive benefit. And therefore, one might ask the question, what is the importance then of having your hands on a patient in a way that is therapeutic, developing that very powerful relationship? What is the connection between the exchange of provider and patient? And how does the system change as we remove ourselves more and more into white coat laboratory medicine that distances the practitioner from the patient and never makes the patient a human being in sentient contact with their provider? I'm exaggerating slightly, but the point I'm trying to make is that I think we can take away from Dr. Valen's study and his colleagues from the Division of Graduate Studies and Research, Canadian Memorial Chiropractic College, and the Los Angeles College of Chiropractic, and the Firestone Regional Chest and Allergy Clinic at St. Joe's Hospital in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, that this collaborative study seems to indicate to me the importance of a sentient patient-practitioner interaction, and that there seems to be something very profound, regardless of the specific technique used, that enhances function on a number of levels. And maybe that should be woven into our treatment protocols in a more real way and not discounted as a placebo effect or an outlier relative to the overall success of any therapy. What we're really talking about here is a theme that has come about in Functional Medicine Update and its preceding Preventive Medicine Update over many years, and that is the question as to how our environment influences the expression of our genes to give rise to the function that we see over the course of living, over decades of life. How do we accumulate this message of interaction between the environment in which we live and ultimately our pre-programmed genetic code? That concept is receiving much more interest in medicine recently, and it really is born out of Dr. Linus Pauling's concept of molecular medicine. I was very intrigued when I saw the recent paper entitled Association Studies of Genetic Polymorphisms in Complex Disease that appeared in The Lancet, Volume 355, page 308 in the year 2000, in which they started to look at the increasing awareness on the part of geneticists of the limits of investigations based on the association of polymorphisms, meaning the genetic difference from individual to individual. Because of the technical simplicity, polymorphic association is used too much, the authors say, and too extensively without any in-depth knowledge of the underlying theory. Geneticists have written some excellent reviews that address genetic and methodological arguments, and they go on to say that there are aspects that are easily comprehensible, and then there are others that probably are much more obscure to the average practicing healthcare provider as to how the interaction between genes and environment and the polymorphic genes gives rise to the expression of phenotype. One should be very cautious, says this report, not to generalize to the mean, looking at populations and mean averages and standard deviations, but rather this whole model has to be applied to the individual. It really is focused on personalized medicine, individualized medicine, in which we're starting to move from the law of the averages, which is the 70-kilogram male patient, to an individualized evaluation of that unique interaction of that person's genomic message and epigenetic patterning and how that interrelates with their environment, environmental exposure, stress factors, environmental factors, exercise, dietary habits, exposure to electromagnetic radiation, all of these variables that influence then how these receptor sites and transmission chemical and electrical communication systems in the body ultimately then shape both the shape of the body and its functional shape. This same theme is mirrored in an article that appeared in Nature Genetics, Volume 24, page 5 in the year 2000, entitled Grassroots Genomic. In this particular paper, they describe how genomics are really starting to come of age and that we still are maybe a few years away from having the techniques of evaluating multiple gene characteristics in individuals as they come into the routine practice of medicine and then being able to interpret how those genes are being expressed and what is the optimal way of modifying their expression to give rise to appropriate function. But certainly we're on the front edge of that because right now we're moving out of the laboratory of the esoteric research specialist and into the clinical laboratory with these DNA gene expression arrays, these technologies. In fact, they go on to say within this article, putting the techniques of today's genomicists within the reach of the rank-and-file clinician is essential if functional genomics, and I kind of like that term, functional genomics is to fulfill its much-heralded promise. The dispersal is just beginning to happen with a few relatively small laboratories, mostly through independent effort, have acquired the ability to measure gene expression with DNA microarrays, a technology formerly accessible only to a few esoteric genomicists. Advances in DNA microwave fabrication techniques promise to reduce the cost of arrays, which should increase their availability to the general medical community, says this article. So we're witnessing the front edge of what will be an exploding revolution in medicine, utilizing genomics to try to understand aspects of the complex array of multigenes to give rise to various phenotypic characteristics, and then how environmental modulators of gene expression in the inducible gene array can in fact be constructed in such a way to personalize the medicine to that patient. I'm going to be talking a little bit more about that in some other aspects of this month's FMU, but one that clearly is very pertinent has to do with the gene-environment interaction in cancer risk. There's a couple of very interesting articles that appeared recently in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, Volume 91, page 1985 in the year 2000, talking about the passive smoking relationship to cancer through the genetic polymorphism of an enzyme or a gene called glutathione S-transferase M1. And we've spoken about this enzyme in previous editions of FMU. This is an enzyme that's found in high concentrations in oxygen-rich tissues that's involved with the glutathione conjugation reactions. It's found very high in the liver, obviously, and it's involved with conjugating glutathione with a xenobiotic or a biotransformed intermediate to produce a mercapturate, a glutathione conjugate, which is then excreted in the bile if it's a higher molecular weight product or in the urine if it's a lower molecular weight product. The tobacco smoke exposure by passive exposure produces an increased carcinogenic risk if the individual has a variant polymorphism of glutathione S-transferase M1, according to this paper, in that the individuals who are less able by their biochemical heritage to detoxify the same exposure to an individual who might have a higher level of glutathione S-transferase M1 puts them at higher risk. This is individualized, I guess you would call it carcinogenic epidemiology. It's cancer epidemiology at the molecular level looking at genetic polymorphism. This is another way of restating the yellow canary premise, that there are those individuals who carry specific genomic risks as identified by their unique metabolic characteristics that are tied to their genes and their environment that then create an increased risk to disease. For someone else, they may not be experiencing that in the same environment at all. This, I think, is a very profound concept because it takes us away from the Mendelian deterministic view of medicine to say that everything was locked into our genes and we could do little about it. We didn't fill out an application card when we were born. Our parents gave us the sperm and the egg, and that's what we've been dealing with ever since. To a more now what I call plastic or modifiable life history, which says, yes, we have locked in principles in our 23 pairs of chromosomes, but the way that those characteristics are expressed can be significantly modified on the basis of what we plunge those genes into, what kind of an environment they're exposed to. Now, this even holds true, it appears, to some of the more problematic genotypes that we're hearing a lot about in the literature recently. For instance, cancer genes, which you've heard about with like RAS mutations and P51, P53 mutations, in which individuals say, well, gee, if you got those mutated genes, there's little you can do and you're at high risk and just woe is you for having the bad luck of the draw. Similarly, for breast cancer genes, you've heard a lot about the BRCA genes, the breast cancer genes. Well, there's a very interesting paper that just appeared in JAMA, General American Medical Association, volume 283, page 617 in the year 2000, in which the authors talk about life expectancy gains from cancer prevention strategies for women who have BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutations, meaning carry with them the genetic propensity towards breast cancer. Now, this is a very powerful concept to me. I mean, for years and years, we have asked the question, could a person with a genetic risk to cancer create a different phenotypic outcome by modifying their environment? And there are those kind of ameliorists or determinists who have said, well, no, if you got that there, that's all you can do. You might as well kind of live while you can with whatever level of lifestyle you would care to engage in, because if you got that message, there's little you can do to escape it, and then medicine is there to rescue you to the best of its possibilities from the ultimate cancer. Obviously, this paper says something different, because using an intervention, in this case, they use some chemopreventive approaches to BRCA expressions in these individuals that have various degrees of penetrance of the BRCA mutation, that they found that using things like tamoxifen therapy, that they were able to alter the actual phenotypic presence of breast cancer in these women who shared risk as a consequence of them carrying the BRCA mutation at different levels of penetrance. This, to me, is a very interesting paper, although obviously it's speaking about tamoxifen therapy. One might also talk about other kinds of environmental interventions that could reduce or alter the expression of these characteristics that give rise to breast cancer, opening the door that the more we learn about altering expression of even some fairly severe mutations, the more we will be able to modify or prevent some of these very serious diseases. By the way, in this particular paper, they examine the effect of tamoxifen, bilateral prophylactic oophorectomy to change estrogen secretion patterns, obviously, and prophylactic contralateral mastectomy in women who had very high degrees of penetrance of BRCA. I think the tamoxifen is the one most interesting because it's an estrogen modulator, obviously, that then has influence secondarily to carrying the relative gene risk. What are the kind of things that we know in the diet are modifying factors? And there's a whole range of substances that are being discovered now that modify gene expression and various oncogenic processes and carcinogenesis. Some of those are found in high concentrations in fruits and vegetables. And I think there's been a tendency, hasn't there, over the last several years to try to find the molecule in fruit or in a specific vegetable that is a chemopreventive agent, be it beta-carotene out of the hundreds of different carotenoids. There's been this tendency to say, let's find the chemical, all trans beta carotene. Let's purify it, let's synthesize it, and let's administer it like a drug to see if we can prevent cancer. And then when the results like the Finnish smoker study don't turn out quite as well as we'd like, we say, well, see, I knew that stuff didn't work. That shows you the invalidity, the non-usefulness of nutrition in preventing cancer. Well, that's a flawed way of approaching this. As you know, we don't eat just beta carotene in the all trans form. We eat in orange, red vegetables and fruits hundreds of different carotenoid isomers and molecules, which all influence differing physiological functions in differing ways. And it is that complex symphony of differing phytonutrients that influences then function. So one might ask, if you believe that one of the events associated with carcinogenesis is mutational injury to the cell causing altered DNA configuration in the genome, DNA adducts or DNA excision mutants, then would it be different if you gave a person a few selected supplements of antioxidants versus giving them a whole fruit and vegetable dietary intake containing hundreds of, probably thousands actually, of redox active compounds as it contrasted to a supplement with one, two, or three? And that's in essence what they report in this article in Carcinogenesis, Volume 24, page 183, in the year 2000. This is an interesting paper in which they looked at white blood cell DNA adducts and mutations in the presence and absence of fruit and vegetable consumption, and they correlated that with bladder cancer. It was very interesting in that they looked at various types of genetic metabolism uniquenesses, so-called polymorphisms. One was the N-acetyl transferase mutations, which are associated with smoking-induced cancers. And what they found is that the fruit and vegetables protects against bladder cancer apparently by inhibiting the formation of DNA adducts in ways that are different, presumably, than any one of the phytonutrients found in fruits and vegetables when given one by itself. So I want to emphasize the synergy that comes to play when you start using a whole food, natural food, rich in fruits and vegetables and minimally processed versus giving single nutrients one at a time and then using a pharmacological model to look at endpoints of cancer. Very different outcome, very different study, and actually this is the kind of thing that people have generally done over millennia. We ate foods, we didn't eat just single nutrients one at a time. Our control systems, our protection systems evolved in that matrix of complex nutrients. There's a very nice review article that Dr. Davis Lamson and Matthew Brignall have recently authored on the antioxidants and their role in helping to ameliorate the secondary side effects of cancer chemotherapy and radiotherapy. This is what they call a quick reference guide. And I want to really honor Drs. Lamson and Brignall for this wonderful review paper and the citations that are associated with it. I think they have done a really scholarly job in assembling nearly 100 references at the back of this paper that describe research on the amelioration of various aspects of chemotherapeutically induced cell damage without uncoupling the therapeutic potential of the drug. So they go through roles of vitamin A, and they broke it down into human studies, animal studies, in vitro studies, and then they have comments. They look at vitamin A, beta-carotene, vitamin C, vitamin E, selenium, coenzyme Q10, melatonin, N-acetylcysteine, glutathione, quercetin. And by the way, they break these down into different types of chemotherapeutic agents, alkylating agents like cyclophosphamide, antibiotic-type agents like doxorubicin or bleomycin. They look at anti-metabolites like 5-FU, 5-fluorouracil, or methotrexate. They look at platinum compounds, cisplatin, and they look at radiotherapy, and they give a variety of different effects of each of those family of substances from both human clinical trials, animal studies, in vitro studies, and then a general comment. So I might urge you to take a look at this review paper. There's a tremendous amount of information included within it. You'll find it in the journal Alternative Medicine Review, Volume 5, page 152 in 2000, and I think it really does summarize a tremendous amount of information in a very readily available form. I should emphasize that there are certainly a tremendous amount of studies that seem to demonstrate the value of specific types of nutrients in amelioration of the adverse signs of cancer therapy. With radiotherapy, the list of nutrients is in the area in human studies, vitamin A, the carotenoids, vitamin C, selenium, melatonin, N-acetylcysteine, glutathione. With platinum compounds, selenium, melatonin, and possibly N-acetylcysteine. If we look at anti-metabolites like 5-FU, vitamin A, and coenzyme Q10, the cardiac effects with doxorubicin, cyclophosphamide, and 5-fluorouracil, and glutathione. So basically there is evidence that without interrupting the therapeutic benefit of these medications, that certain nutritional follow-up strategies might be considered desirable. Again, I urge you to review of that article. We also recognize that the response that a person has to a chemotherapeutic drug is going to be related to their detoxification pathways, how their body is programmed to detoxify, the so-called genomics of their detoxification. This is a whole new approach that's occurring in pharmacology, which is to try to understand something about a person's detox phase 1 and phase 2 activities by assessing the activities prior to the administration of a medication. Then if you know the method of metabolism and detoxification of that medicine, you can then track back how that person might respond to it based upon their genetic uniqueness. And so is the case for mercaptopurine, looking at pharmacogenetics and optimizing the dose based upon how a person would metabolize the drug. This is a very different approach than just saying, well, we'll use so much dose per body surface area, not understanding some of the differences in metabolism. So you can see how medicine is transitioning to personalized medicine based upon genomics. By the way, that paper I just described is found in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, Volume 91, page 1983 in 1999. And mercaptopurine therapy can have intolerance as a consequence of heterozygosity in the S-methyltransferase gene locus. So one can actually look at methylation reactions and track it back to how a person responds to the therapy and what dose is necessary to get positive response. So I think we're really starting to see some extraordinary progress being made in taking the philosophy of genomics and then converting it into an actual diagnostic and treatment applied concept. Going back to where we are in functional medicine, you know, a lot has been kind of throwing out the baby with the bathwater because supposedly by some outcome-based study from observation, there was results from something doing something valuable, but because it didn't have a mechanism or didn't have a randomized clinical control trial, we just discounted it, saying it's unscientific and medicine is only based on scientific principles, so we can't include it. One of those, obviously, is degenerative joint disease or osteoarthritis in the connection with oral glucosamine sulfate and chondroitin treatment, which in the United States for some time has been really criticized by traditional medicine as having no basis in good science. Although in Europe there are some studies, particularly Italy, that were published demonstrating benefit in osteoarthritis with glucosamine sulfate supplementation, Because those studies weren't done in America, and because we tend to be very parochial and provincial, we didn't accept that, and therefore the traditional party line has been no good science supporting glucosamine and chondroitin. And I think most of us were very intrigued when we saw the Journal of the American Medical Association report on glucosamine and chondroitin for the treatment of osteoarthritis, which was a systematic quality assessment and meta-analysis. I would urge you to read this paper. I think it's quite interesting, both for the specifics of the paper and for the general consideration of how one makes decision based upon a variety of inferential data by meta-analysis, because there are other ways of getting to conclusions of hypotheses other than just the double-blind randomized clinical controlled trial, which may be very useful for evaluating single outcome from a single agent, but may be more complicated and less useful when trying to look at multiple agents or several agents against multiple outcome parameters. The results of this paper are that trials of glucosamine and chondroitin preparations for osteoarthritis symptoms demonstrated that moderate to large effects were seen. Quality issues, however, related to the product quality and its reproducible quality have made some of these outcome studies have more scatter and noise about the midpoint than probably a pharmacology study where using well-defined single-molecule materials. However, I think the takeaway is that there's something that certainly is worthwhile when the number of studies that were examined were over 10 studies from 1994 through 1998, with subjects ranging from as small as 17, the Kurzberg study in 1987, to as large as 329, the Rovati study in 1997. All were oral administration except for the Rovetta study in 1991, intramuscular administration, and all showing a positive outcome from glucosamine and or glucosamine chondroitin. We're moving into a different era, aren't we, in which we're looking at outcome analyses, we're looking at pattern recognition, cluster analysis, multifactorial or multiparameter analysis, and meta-analysis to try to help us to better come to clinical decisions based upon information. Let's move this discussion into another area that we've described, which has to do with cardiac risk, because as you know, Dr. Paul Ridker, which we've discussed his work in the past, cardiologist at the Harvard Medical School, has been helping us to better understand that there are risk factors for cardiac disease beyond that of the traditional risk factors of cholesterol, smoking, hypertension, diabetes, obesity, and sedentary lifestyles, and that these additional risk factors relate to performance criteria that couple together the heart not just as a pump but as an endocrine organ, as a response to inflammatory mediators, as a neurogenic organ in some perspectives. And I was very intrigued when I saw this recent paper in the New England Journal of Medicine, volume 342, page 829 in 2000, talking about abnormal myocardial phosphorus 31 nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy results in women who had chest pain but normal coronary angiograms. Now, I want to emphasize the concept of diagnosis. When do you cross the boundary to become a definable diagnosis? If they had by angiograms normal coronary angiograms, but yet they had chest pain, do they have a functional disorder that precedes the angiogram? That's an interesting question. And that's what they were trying to examine utilizing a functional assessment tool called Phosphor 31 or P31 NMR. This measures in exercising muscle the ability for ATP to be recharged, to be generated, and to be utilized. So it evaluates ATP to inorganic phosphate ratios as a measurement of biochemical energetics. It's a very interesting concept. And so it's a functional measure of energy economy, which obviously indirectly relates to a whole series of events, oxygen perfusion, mitochondrial oxidative phosphorylation, energy transport through the cytochrome systems. It's a biochemical energy assessment tool utilizing really the exercising muscle as the model. And what they found was direct evidence of an abnormal metabolic response to exercise, and they used hand grip as the exercise, which was strongly correlated with women with chest pain, even in the absence of angiographically significant coronary stenosis, meaning this may be a functional early warning predictor of later stage problems. You're catching it early on, so to speak, as an energy deficit disorder of the cardiac muscle that may have come from many variables that are not necessarily picked up yet by coronary angiogram. I think this is a very, very interesting study from a functional medicine perspective. We know that in the cases where there's temporal ischemia, low oxygen delivery, a mitochondrial uncoupling, where you move from oxidative phosphorylation to extramitochondrial anaerobic glycolysis so that the cell's trying to keep their energy production going by a secondary backup mechanism, that in those cases there's increased oxidative stress, and therefore there's increased glutathione turnover, increased reactivity of antioxidants to try to defend against these oxidants that are produced during ischemia, hydroxyl radical, superoxide radical, singlet oxygen, and hydrogen peroxide. So one might ask, gee whiz, if you've got a person that has these early predictor risks with low ATP recharge rates and how that correlates to chest pain, could they not also have indicators of oxidative stress? So what is a good oxidative stress marker? Is it 8-hydroxydeoxyguanosine in the DNA of lymphocytes that indicates oxidative damage to DNA? Is it whole blood glutathione levels in the reduced versus oxidized form? Is it serum lipid peroxides using thiobarbituric acid analysis to look at lipid peroxidation byproducts? Or could it be other variables like isoprostanes that are a family of prostaglandins that are produced as a consequence of increased oxidant reaction with arachidonic acid to form these cyclic endoperoxide derivatives that indicate oxidative stress? Well, one of the other markers that was found recently, at least defined in Clinical Chemistry, the journal Clinical Chemistry, volume 46, page 145 in the year 2000, is to look at the amount of glutathione that is conjugated to hemoglobin as a clinical marker of oxidative stress. As you know, there has been substantial interest in oxidative stress and the potential role it has in the development of many chronic diseases, including not only atherosclerosis and other cardiovascular diseases, but also diabetes and cancer and accelerated aging and brain dysfunction that we'll talk about a little bit later in this month's Functional Medicine Update. Oxidative stress was, as you know, defined by the German chemist Dr. Helmut Sies, that's S-I-E-S, and it refers to an imbalance between antioxidant and oxidant-generating systems. An increase in oxidative stress has a profound effect on lipoprotein modification, causing oxidized lipoproteins, on transcription, because these are cell signal transduction agents, and cell function and metabolism. Oxidative stress can also arise via various mechanisms associated with excess oxygen radical production, such as oxidation of glucose and glycated proteins and the glycation of antioxidant enzymes. Even in healthy people, high blood sugar is found to be associated with increased fatty acids and hyperinsulinemia, and these trigger oxidative stress. So it's a functional measure well before a pathophysiological measure. In this recent paper in Clinical Chemistry, they found that in diabetic subjects with increased oxidative stress, that there was a very high level in their blood of glutathione-conjugated hemoglobin. This seemed to be a marker of insulin-related, dysglycemic, insulin-resistant-related oxidation. Therefore, we could put this on the list of oxidation clinical markers, what we call free radical oxidative stress clinical markers. So going back over those, we have LDL oxidation, we have F2 alpha isoprostanes, these arachidonic acid derivatives that resemble prostaglandins. We have the lipid peroxides, the blood peroxides, malonaldehyde byproducts, basically. We have protein glycation products as seen in using things like glycohemoglobin or glycosylated albumin or fructosamine, which are all measurements of glycation. We've got things like 8-OHDG, 8-hydroxydeoxyguanosine, damage of DNA in white cells. And now we add also to that glutathionyl hemoglobins as a benchmark for oxidative stress. We know that oxidative stress occurs also in chronic conditions, and one of those that's been looked at very intensively by our group and many others around the world is chronic fatigue syndrome and its companion problem, fibromyalgia. Dr. Martin Paul, who we've interviewed as a Researcher of the Month in Functional Medicine Update a couple of years ago, the Department of Biochemistry, Biophysics, and the Program in Basic Medical Sciences, Washington State University, has recently published a paper following up on his discussion with us about the association of oxidative stress markers and chronic fatigue syndrome fibromyalgia. The title of this paper is Elevated Sustained Peroxynitrite Levels as the Cause of Chronic Fatigue Syndrome. And this is a medical hypothesis built around some very, very interesting data and publications. This appeared in the journal Medical Hypothesis, volume 54, page 115, in the year 2000. And what Dr. Paul points out once again is that upregulation of the immune system, which then induces macrophage production of nitric oxide, when there is a oxidative stress environment producing more superoxide, the combination of nitric oxide with superoxide produces a secondary chemical called peroxynitrite. Peroxynitrite is a very powerful and caustic chemical that damages DNA and starts creating a cascade of events that then depletes the ATP, or energy reserves, by upregulation of an enzyme called PARS, polyadenyl ribosomal synthase, or PARP is another name, P-A-R-P, polyadenyl ribosomal polymerase. This enzyme then creates a depletion, when activated, a depletion of ATP and produces the energy deficit in that tissue. It's all precipitated by a feed-forward lock-in of the immune system that is associated then with nitric oxide and oxidative stress, superoxide, being formed, and it tends to be like a dog chasing its tail, according to Dr. Paul. The etiology, therefore, of chronic fatigue syndrome fibromyalgia, although still obscure and contentious, may in fact relate to some events, maybe more than one event, but a series of events that upregulate the immune system to produce more pro-inflammatory cytokines like IL-1, TNF-alpha, and interferon-gamma. These induce subsequently then nitric oxide production from macrophages, which in turn reacts with superoxide radical to generate the potent oxidant that I mentioned, peroxynitrite. Multiple amplification and positive feedback mechanisms then create a perpetuation of this environment that lead then to a continued depletion of energy and cellular damage. And this is why maybe a single event, like the person who got the flu that never went away, can for years later still have a memory effect that we call fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue. And it seems to be a total load effect. It's related to all sorts of variables that may work together to upregulate the immunological system and produce this cascade of events associated with oxidative stress and nitric oxide production of peroxynitrite. I think this is very interesting because it also leads us into therapeutic potentials. Lowering the load of antigenic and immunologically active substances to cool off the immune system is step one. Improving the basement membrane and mitochondrial membrane production with the essential fatty acids of the omega-3 and omega-6 GLA is number two, and cooling off the pro-inflammatory eicosanoids. Number three would be balanced redox active substances, coenzyme Q10, N-acetylcysteine, glutathione, vitamin E, lipoic acid. These would be considered potentially useful, and that's certainly what we have found in our clinical studies with chronic fatigue syndrome. Next would be improving hepatic detoxification to lower the load of substances that create upregulation of Kupffer cell production of these inflammatory cytokines. So that would be, again, dietary modulation of hepatic detoxification and gastrointestinal mucosal detoxification. And, of course, lastly is improving the gastrointestinal ecology, reducing toxic load of endotoxins and improving mucosal barrier function of the gut, which means gut restoration, the so-called 4R program that we've described at length, which includes the 4Rs as remove, replace, reinoculate, and repair. That kind of complex intervention strategy gives the practitioner a variety of different approaches to work together in concert to lower the precipitating factors that keep this feed-forward cycle of inflammation and immunological upregulation in place and therefore break this vicious cycle in the chronic fatigue patient. By the way, this also seems to have relationships to even things like age and energy loss as found in cancer patients. I was very intrigued to see in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, Volume 92, page 290 in the year 2000, a paper entitled, Is ATP, adenosine triphosphate, a performance-enhancing additive for the tanks of cancer patients? Because it turns out this low-energy fatigue relates also to the same mechanism of PARP activation and ATP depletion. And therefore, if you can keep the mitochondria functioning, keep ATP up and running, and by reducing these inflammatory-mediated oxidative stress reactions, that you can keep a process of function at a much higher level. So you'll notice that even from the pathological perspective, there is something very interesting to say about these mechanisms that tend to tie disease states together into single explanations for intervention, from the functional chronic state all the way through the pathophysiological state. As we look at risk factors to pathological disorders that start as early warning changes in function, and we've been talking here about cardiac disease originally, and then we moved over into things like chronic fatigue and cancer, I'd like to come back to say that there are other risk factors that Dr. Ridker talks about that certainly relate to functional changes associated with vascular diseases and other chronic diseases of aging. One of those are immunological changes associated with the inflammatory cascade and how that relates then to what Dr. Rudolf Virchow, the brilliant German physiologist and medical doctor, told us was the origin of atherosclerosis way back when, which was inflammatory condition, not a cholesterol condition. And it's interesting to note that in The Lancet, just recently, volume 355, page 468 in the year 2000, a paper was published entitled Salivary Endothelin Concentrations in the Assessment of Chronic Heart Failure. I find this fascinating because, first of all, here's another salivary marker that is being assessed, showing the saliva is getting much more review as both a prognostic biological fluid of interest and maybe a diagnostic medium for evaluation. In this particular paper, they showed that salivary endothelin concentrations were elevated in patients with chronic heart failure and indicate the progression of disease severity. This is quite interesting because you know that plasma concentrations of vasoconstrictor peptide endothelin 1 are raised 2 to 3-fold in patients with chronic heart failure. They correlate with hemodynamic alterations and functional impairments of the heart well before the onset of severe pathology and are an independent marker of outcome from other variables that have been studied. Plasma endothelin 1 concentrations are lowered by drug treatment for chronic heart failure that are known to reduce mortality, so it looks like a pretty good prospective marker. What we are seeing is that salivary levels, assessing this endocrine and immune interrelationship to heart function, is a good assessment tool. So endothelin, salivary analysis, heart function. With that in mind, let's turn to Site 2 and continuation of Functional Medicine Update this July issue.
You know, we're really fortunate this month, as we have been for the last couple of years, to have an extraordinary intellect, personality, visionary, Dr. Robert Sapolsky, as our researcher of the month for this month's edition. Dr. Sapolsky is at Stanford University and has written the best-selling book, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. He's also authored the book, The Trouble with Testosterone, which is a very interesting, I could identify with that book very strongly, by the way, for a variety of reasons, because his pass through graduate school and into manhood has been an interesting, and we also share playing the trombone together, which we found in a recent meeting in Arizona. Dr. Sapolsky has been called the Renaissance man, a potential Nobel Prize nominee. I mean, many accolades have been discussed in the literature, and they're all very justified. Having heard him speak at our International Symposium on Functional Medicine in Tucson in 1999, he was one of our most highly evaluated speakers as a presenter at our Applied Functional Medicine and Clinical Practice training program in Gig Harbor. He just riveted our clinicians there in discussing precepts of neurology and what's happening in the area of Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease. This is an individual who cuts across everything from Melvin Koner's work in medical anthropology all the way to molecular biology. So it's really a great treat and privilege to have Dr. Sapolsky as our interviewee this month. What I ask him to maybe help us understand is how the intellectual fabric, warp and weft of the field that we call medicine is changing and where that might lead us as we move here into the 21st century. So, Dr. Sapolsky, it's a great treat and privilege to have you as part of our FMU this month.
Well, thanks. Glad to be talking, and obviously you've been talking to my mother, so.
I'd like to maybe, first of all, get you to tell us a little bit about your present position at Stanford, and very interesting university with distributive education systems that allows people to range across different disciplines. What all are you up to there?
Well, let's see. I think somewhat reflecting my probably sort of dilettantish range of interests, technically a professor in biological sciences at the university, in neurology at the medical school, and I think I'm what's called an adjunct in their human biology program, which is this very nice program that Stanford has, which is trying to look at biology and disease in the context of the person in which it's happening, and thus including all sorts of social and societal factors as well. In addition, I'm also a research associate over at the National Museums of Kenya in their Primate Center, and some of what I also do is sort of field endocrinology on wild primates each year. I think it kind of reflects the range of stuff I've been thinking about, which is broadly in three areas. The first one is how a neuron dies as a result of aging, as a result of neurological insults, acute ones like stroke or seizure, prolonged ones like Alzheimer's disease. What are some of the common features of the cell biology of neuronal vulnerability? Because the second area I've been thinking about for a long time is the role of stress in potentially accelerating such neuron loss, and that's basically bad news all around, and the possibility of designing gene therapy strategies to save a neuron during one of these neurological crises. I guess the third area is the one that I more concentrate on in my East African research, is amid basically all this bad news about stress and its adverse effects on health, Nonetheless, most of us have not collapsed into puddles of stress-related disease. Most of us cope, and this persistent mystery is why some individuals cope so much better than others. And what I try to understand with these wild baboons that I've been going back to year after year for 20 years now is, what does your social rank, your social behavior, your personality have to do with which baboons get the stress-related diseases and which don't?
Well, that leaves us a pretty broad playing field that we can obviously talk about. I guess one of the things that immediately pops out to me, and I'm sure it does to our listeners, is when you look at that range of interests, one might summarize or distill that down into how does the environment and experience that the environment provides ultimately influence through various proprioceptor systems and neurological sensory systems, cell biological function. And so it moves to different levels of organization from the macrocyclic down to ultimately the biochemical. Could you tell us, I guess, just from a strategy as to how you approach coupling together what you observe in East Africa, ultimately down even to the studies that you're doing at the cell level?
Well, with success at various points, I think one of the things that is most driven is that the field work, the primatology work with these wild baboons, basically makes perpendicular one of the things that plagues any laboratory scientist, and the view definitely is that this is a plague, which is you study something or other and you're hoping for some nice effect as a result of the manipulation that you've done, and the absolute bane of every lab scientist's existence is, oh no, you get a lot of variability in your endpoint. You get a large standard error, you get a big spread of your points. Oh no, what that means is you don't have a clear result, it's not significant, you got to do the experiment over, you're not going to get your grant, you're not going to get your tenure, variability is a bad thing. And what the field work is entirely built around is variability is not only inevitable, but it's a great thing. What that means is, amid a general picture of, you know, the adverse effects of aging, of stress and that sort, there's always a subset of individuals who are doing spectacularly. And sort of lab science has finally formalized this in one area, gerontology, this whole subfield now of successful aging. What used to be the irritating source of variability, oh no, 10 to 15% of subjects don't have renal filtration rates get worse with age, don't have blood pressure rise with age, etc. Instead, they're doing just fine, they're even doing better. Instead of that being an irritant, that's now viewed as the most damn interesting thing to focus on there. What are they doing right? Where can the rest of us sign up? So I think the thing that the field work has mostly left me with is a taste for idiosyncratic individual differences, even in inbred lab mice and rats.
I hope I'm not going to put you on the spot here, but I'd like to ask a question that follows up from that very insightful comment that relates to what we have often heard as the gold standard. And many doctors who took their basic sciences in medical school learned about the double-blind, placebo-controlled, randomized clinical controlled trial as if it's the only way of answering a question, a hypothesis. And we're often confronted with this in a society where a lot of our actions are not single actions against single endpoints. How do we use RCTs to answer these questions that might be very valuable? Do you see any limitations in the RCT to address, or the way that the double-blind placebo-controlled trial has been conceived in answering some of these complicated questions of outliers, which may be at the ends of the Gaussian curve?
Sure. I think there's exactly that problem that you point out, which is picking up the outliers, and with this notion that outliers are potentially vastly interesting, the most interesting thing you see. What I think the other limitation is that in the gold standard approach, that precludes all sorts of types of studies, and ones where, of necessity, you're never going to be able to do that type of manipulation because you're pulling out correlative data. You can't do sort of a double-blind control on an entire society, that sort of thing, and that's going to be the realm in which we're dealing with really interesting stuff out there, socioeconomic gradients to health, and trying to figure out what that's about and that sort of thing. I mean, sort of ironically, there's a personal realm where I'm constantly butting my head against this, which is my wife and I happen to have two young children, a three-year-old and a one-year-old, and there's something absolutely crazy-making for a scientist to suddenly have to make sense of that entire literature out there of, you know, the sort of 10-second sound bites of 3 minutes a day of Mozart and you triple the SAT scores and double the myelination in your offspring's brain kind of stuff. Whereas a scientist, you sit there and say, these are studies that don't fit any of our basic rules as to how do you control for them, and then you realize you can't do those sorts of studies with kids. What parent is going to consent to that? You can't do those sorts of studies with normative pregnancies. You can't do those studies with the sort of societal levels of health psychology issues that are critical, I think you point out the absolute limitations. It's a wonderful experimental, a wonderful testing approach for one very, very limited realm of clinical medicine. You got to come up with some clever solutions to get at a lot of other interesting questions.
In terms of helping in decision-making, which is obviously going to be a continuing theme within medicine as we try to evaluate new technologies, new approaches, what other kinds of strategies might be available for addressing questions other than the double-blind placebo-controlled trial?
Well, in some ways, one is turfed back in some realms to the anthropological approach, which one version of that is the case report or the single society or single culture report, which has a lot of limitations. But the other is in circumstances where you can't do an experimental manipulation, what you need to do is just get a huge array of examples and see are there predictive rules that cut across all of these different social groups, all these different settings, all these different societies, in the zoological version, all these different species, where you can't do an experiment with culture, you can't do an experiment with evolution, but if you see across 20 different species, 11 different cultures, there's certain patterns that allow you a certain predictiveness, that, after a while, winds up being science.
Let's take an example of that. If you could kind of take us through what you've learned in your stress and brain aging research, can we use that as kind of an example of how one walks through looking at various information and filtering it down into hypotheses that can be tested?
Sure. Actually, I think a realm that might be even more accessible is some of the baboon work, which is sort of one of the themes I've had in there over the years, is if you're going to be a baboon running around the Serengeti and you get a choice in the matter, you don't want to be a low-ranking baboon. One of the things that you find is subordinate animals have elevated blood pressure, elevated basal levels of corticosteroids, less optimal immune function, less of the insulin-like growth factors needed for wound repair, a whole array of things that we now recognize increase the likelihood of various stress-related diseases. And in a general way, this makes perfect sense if you're a subordinate animal because you have an awful lot of the physical stressors disproportionately. You have an awful lot of the psychological stressors. You're working harder for your food. You don't have as much control, predictability over resources. Okay, so seemingly we've just learned something about rank and physiology. And in the sort of thing that makes it very difficult to actually do a manipulative experiment out in the wild, what you begin to see is nonetheless having a certain rank means a very different thing in a different sort of primate society. And a word that's actually used these days in primatology that's not anthropomorphic at all is that different primate groups have differing cultures. And this is an absolutely seriously accepted term these days. And when in the realm of baboons, one of the things you find is in some troops it's crummier to be a low-ranking animal than in other troops. There's more displaced aggression. There's less control of resources. Food is more limited. You may have fewer outlets for your frustration, fewer animals are willing to groom you, that sort of thing. And one of the things that I've now seen across a number of different troops is it's not just your rank, but it's the sort of society in which that rank is occurring. And that's the sort of correlative evidence. It would be very tough out in the wild to do a manipulative study where you now generate a different sort of primate society that's generally quite frowned upon, removing individuals, giving food, removing food, that sort of thing. And instead you look at the variability that comes across and you begin to see something interesting. In much the same way, an absolutely fascinating thing to me in terms of the gradient between socioeconomic status and health in humans is what was initially a story very much about healthcare access. Ooh, major, major health deficits if you are poor in a westernized capitalist country. It's got to have something to do with healthcare access because you can't afford to go to the doctor as readily. Do the cross-cultural approach and suddenly you see the gradient is virtually as strong in socialist countries, virtually as strong in countries with universal healthcare access, and look at 30 different societies with very different economic systems showing the same pattern and you've just learned some important stuff. Probably has nothing to do with healthcare access.
That's fascinating, and I know that you've spoken at length about this concept of, well, I guess the alliteration of the term is locus of control and how that translates into a sense of perceived stress. Is that locus of control function something that's modifiable in the perception of the individual, do you think? Is that a training system that one can employ to alter these neurochemicals that are associated with long-term functional changes?
Absolutely, and two levels of answers to that. The first one is on the individual organismal level. It's a hell of a big modifier of physiology. And classic sort of experiments, You take two lab rats, they both get shocks now and then, electric shocks, the same exact shocks, same intensity, same duration, same everything. Their body's being challenged to exactly equivalent extents, but one of them has its psychological environment manipulated so that it has a sense of control. It can press a lever, which it believes decreases the likelihood of a shock. Or perhaps that rat has predictive information. A warning light goes on 10 seconds before each shock, manipulated psychological setting in which that physical stressor occurs. And what the studies show is you can cause a tenfold difference in the likelihood of an ulcer, the likelihood of hypertension, things of that sort. So this internal locus of control stuff, the psychological baggage, the psychological filters with which an external trauma occurs, can have an enormous impact on health outcomes. The second level is a more societal one, which is showing that despite sort of a punchline, ooh, an internal locus of control is a good thing, it isn't always a good thing. Really interesting exception, in that there is a personality profile called John Henryism, which is very predictive of cardiovascular disease, hypertension, and what John Henryism basically is about is a real extreme version of an inner locus of control. And these are individuals who on personality profiles endorse statements like, when the going gets tough, I just work harder, there's no problem you can't solve just by applying yourself to it, if some fella disagrees with me, just talking to him, we should be able to see eye to eye after a while. This sounds terrific. This is a very internal locus of control. Just by effort, you can overcome the problems thrown at you. That sounds like a wonderful thing. Why is this associated with an adverse health outcome? Because of who is occurring in, John Henryism is a marker of hypertension in working-class African-Americans. And a characteristic there is you get societal problems thrown at you that you're not going to be able to solve by just working harder. You get, for example, racism thrown at you that you're not going to be able to overcome by just sitting down with a guy and realizing we're all the same and finding common bonds. And these are people dealing with very uncontrollable external sources of stress with a coping style that assumes they can control the uncontrollable. And you wind up seeing that this personality style is highly predictive of hypertension in working-class African-Americans, and it's not predictive of hypertension in middle-class blacks or working-class whites. And I think in that case you see, insofar as psychological baggage can be highly protective, once again in certain societal settings, it works a lot better than in other cases.
You give an example in your book and also in a couple of the talks that I've heard you present that is quite fascinating. It's maybe the outlier example, but it certainly gets our attention as the impact of stress on physiological function, and that's related to J.T. Barry and stress-induced dwarfism. Could you just briefly describe a little bit of that, because that might really get people to think of this across a wide range of spectrum of effects.
Fabulous story that I cannot resist. Within the realm of this disorder, stress dwarfism, psychogenic dwarfism, psychosocial dwarfism, this very rare zebra disorder in pediatric endocrinology of kids who are so psychologically stressed that they will stop growing. And its characteristic is it doesn't involve disease, malnutrition, parasites, the mechanisms on the neuroendocrine level are reasonably well understood, and the main theme about it is that this is absolutely rare, obligatory cases in every textbook chapter on growth hormone. Nonetheless, this is a very rare state, extreme needs of stress for it to occur, but what you wind up doing is you look through history and there's been all sorts of interesting examples of stress dwarfism, kids in war zones, kids in areas of civil strife, and what I always love coming back to is what strikes me as the single most bizarre, unnerving example of stress dwarfism I've ever heard of. And this is one that got prompted in me sort of to investigate years ago when, you know, reading a lot about growth hormone, noticing a lot of these textbook chapters had inexplicably these weird references to Peter Pan. They would have some quote from Peter Pan or some snide comment about Tinkerbell. I had seen this for years. I had no idea what was going on. So one day I finally saw the explanation. And this was a textbook chapter talking about psychological regulation of growth hormone release, stress dwarfism, gave the following case history. 8-year-old boy growing up in Victorian England in the 1870s, one day he sees his beloved older brother, 12-year-old brother, killed in front of him, horrible accident, trauma destroys the whole family, no other siblings, the father was never on the scene. This was the mother's favorite child who had died in this Victorian swoon she takes to her room with the shades drawn for the next decade or so. And this kid is growing up in this sort of horrible emotional isolation, you know, these terrible scenes. He's bringing a tray of food into the mother in the bedroom and she says, "Oh, David, David, is that you? David, the dead son. David, is that you? Have you come back to me? Oh, it's only you." This eight-year-old growing up being only you. And apparently the only thing the mother ever spoke to him about was this crazy idea she had grabbed onto, which was, if David had to have died, at least he died when he was perfect. He was still a little boy. He's not one of these boys who grows up and doesn't need his mother anymore. He'll always need his mother because he was this perfect little boy who didn't grow up, didn't grow up. This kid hears this with a vengeance. Wealthy family, no evidence of malnutrition, no evidence of disease. The kid stopped growing at this point, lives to be 60, 4'10" as an adult, confirmed on autopsy, never reaches puberty, unconsummated marriage, totally bizarre example of stress dwarfism. And then the chapter concludes by informing us this was J.M. Barrie, the author of Peter Pan, who, if you read about this man's adulthood, was an incredibly disturbed man. He had endless sadomasochistic relations with little boys that he had to keep buying his way out of from the police and from the newspapers. He produced book after play after novella about boys who die and come back as ghosts and marry their mothers and all sorts of stuff like that. Really bizarre example of this psychosocial disease and this man's very unsuccessful lifelong attempts, I think, to deal with it. Absolutely bizarre story.
Thank you for sharing that. I think that's a really fascinating example of the mind-body connection. And can you tell us a little bit of your opinion? You're hitting on growth hormone, and in your endocrinology reviews and research, I'm sure you've caught on that there is a lot of tendency now with aging humans to use growth hormone support or replacement therapy, and it's been kind of a back-and-forth discussion within the literature as to whether the risk-benefit is on what side of the equation. Do you have any thoughts about growth hormone replacement in adults who are just trying to prevent some of the signs of aging, improving muscle strength, skin tone, and vitality?
It's not my area of endocrinology, but my basic gut reflex is to be skeptical and cautious, in part because of the tendency of clinicians to over-pathologize normative aging. On the other hand, I'm in my early 40s, so I'm only beginning to over-pathologize my normative biology a little bit myself. Nonetheless, the results are pretty impressive in those studies in terms of the good outcomes, energy, muscle mass, sense of well-being. Probably the safest thing is excessive amounts of moderation in this regard. Be real, real cautious about the potential side effects. The realm that I'm much more concerned about and that I've been on this sort of evangelical bandwagon over the last month or so since this is sort of splattered all over the media is this excitement about Androgel about to be coming on market, and this is going to be the user-friendly replacement of injectable androgens for testosterone therapy, and instead this gel that's rubbed on the skin and is absorbable, and as I'm sure lots of listeners will know, this is just an absolute hysterics in the media about this. Cover story in Time magazine, New York Times Sunday magazine section, every single TV station covering how this is not only going to be fabulous for pathology, cases of very, very marked testicular suppression related to HIV, you know, things of that sort, but where this is going to be a panacea for normative age-related declines in males and testosterone levels. And this is a totally erroneous read of the literature. What the literature is absolutely clear on is, on the average, there's not a big decline in testosterone levels in normative aging, roughly a 50% decline from age 20 to age 60 or so, and most importantly, reinstating testosterone levels up to that 100% level, a million studies have shown, will have no effect on levels of aggression, levels of sexuality, libido, sexual performance, no effect on muscle metabolism. Testosterone is a classic permissive hormone, which is to say you need this stuff for normative physiology and behavior, but anywhere from roughly 10% of normal levels up to about 200%, you're going to get the same effects. It has a step function. So get below the 10% level with pathology, and testosterone replacement is going to be real helpful. Take yourself some tons of anabolic steroids and abuse yourself above the 200% range, and there's probably going to be some psychological effects there, but stay within the normative range of 95% of healthy males, and manipulating testosterone isn't really to do much of anything. I suspect we are about to enter a realm of some astonishing placebo effects.
That's fascinating. Thank you for sharing that. We just have a few minutes left, I know, with your busy schedule, but I thought it might be very helpful for our listeners to kind of get a vision of the future as you see it related to neurodegenerative diseases and these things that maybe just as few as a few years ago were considered intractable and incurable and maybe even a natural part of the aging process. And I know that you've got some very nice connections into the community and your own work related to neurologic aging related phenomena pertaining to things like Parkinson's or Alzheimer's. Could you give us just a vignette as to where you see this research taking us?
Some very encouraging news. Within the realm of incremental preventative medicine stuff, it may not do much good in terms of what you can do once a neurological disaster occurs, but we're seeing some very exciting trends in Alzheimer's disease, for example, indications that somebody in their 50s, a woman who can safely do postmenopausal estrogen replacement, people of either gender who can take relatively small amounts of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory compounds for quite a few years on end, intellectual stimulation, environmental enrichment, all of these are turning out to be pretty substantial modifiers of the risk for Alzheimer's disease. And pretty substantial, like in the range of a 50 to 70% decrease in the likelihood of late onset Alzheimer's. This is absolutely extraordinary in terms of the good news. On other realms, the what could be done once all hell breaks loose and the Parkinson's has occurred, the stroke has occurred, the grand mal seizure, all of that, the realm of neurotrophic factors, compounds that can stimulate neuronal division or elaboration of neuronal processes, the realm of neuronal transplants, the realm of gene therapy to save a neuron right in the aftermath of one of these disasters, and this recent revolution of understanding that the adult brain, even the aged brain, still undergoes neurogenesis, which overthrew 100 years dogma, ooh, you've got all the neurons you're ever going to have by age 3. All of these are areas of tremendous optimism in terms of being able to prevent the neuron loss in the aftermath of a neurological disaster, replace the neurons by stimulating neurogenesis or neuronal transplants, and getting the remaining neurons to make more complex branch points, arborizations, by way of these neurotrophins. Tremendous optimism in the field at this point.
You had mentioned in the list of potential therapeutic approaches for prevention, the NSAIDs, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatories, and that suggests obviously that there may be an inflammatory component of Alzheimer's and other neurodegenerative diseases, and that may also then interrelate stress with inflammation and microglial function. Is there a theme emerging to suggest that chronic mediators of stress have a relationship to inflammation, which has a relationship to brain aging?
At this point, it's not completely clear, mainly because inflammatory pathways, inflammatory cytokines are just so damn complicated. For the most part, the stress hormones, in particular the corticosteroids, have a well-earned reputation for being anti-inflammatory. Within the nervous system, far less of a precedent for such anti-inflammatory effects and some evidence for pro-inflammatory effects. So in that regard, the jury is still out as to just how much ongoing stress can contribute to sort of chronic inflammation within the nervous system in response to ongoing neuron death. What's clear, though, is within that framework of that hesitancy, inflammation itself has moved to sort of center stage in neurodegeneration in a way people simply didn't used to pay attention to. You look at the old Alzheimer's literature 20, 30 years ago, and the neuropathology is absolutely screaming inflammation, and it was always ignored by most individuals because of the view that this was a nonspecific marker and a nonspecific consequence of the neuron loss. And what is clear now from the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory studies, from the more experimental manipulative ones as well, is that inflammation not only is quite early on in the process, but is playing a major role in secondary damage, lose a neuron and get uncontrolled inflammation in that neighborhood, and that's really not going to be a good thing for the neighboring neurons. And inflammation is really center stage now for understanding Alzheimer's and some of the other chronic degenerative diseases as well.
Do you feel that the work that Dr. Stanley Pressener has been involved with prions and the discovery of how these proteoid molecules may in fact influence certain functions within the nervous system is the opening up of a chapter that will have sequential chapters in this text, or do you think it's just an outlier discovery that has a unique, isolated implication?
I personally think it's astounding stuff. I've been watching his work since when I was a grad student at a conference where he first presented his heretical notion of the protein-only transmissible agent, and people walked out of there saying, this guy just destroyed his career, this was madness. And it's been amazing seeing it culminating in what was for the Nobel Committee a pretty risky decision to choose somebody while it's still a controversial subject rather than in every single textbook out there. What remains uncertain is, number one, how much prion diseases are going to impact life. And it has moved from, you know, a couple of obscure textbook diseases in New Guinea to explaining an awful lot of scary stuff with Creutzfeldt-Jakob and atypical variants going on in the United Kingdom. Whether that is going to be a pandemic in the United States, nobody is clear at all. And how much prion diseases will indeed impact us in other realms of medicine remains unclear. The other thing that is unclear are still a few of the mechanisms that Prusiner has pushed. There are still reasons to be perhaps a little bit skeptical about the protein-only notion, and Prusiner and others are now looking for factor X modulatory factors, which could well still be a virus, a traditional virus containing nucleic acids. What has been totally revolutionary on Prusiner's part is getting people to think about the structure of proteins, and most of all, multiple conformations of proteins with the exact same amino acid sequence, and these multiple conformations having real different consequences for disease. Get the wrong conformation and proteins start aggregating and you've got a plaque disease, and that is suddenly all over the place in chronic neurodegenerative disease and vascular disease. This plaque stuff, this misaggregation of proteins if they're in the wrong conformation, was an utter backwater, and it has now moved physical chemistry to the forefront of disease research. And he's been an utter lone voice and pioneer in that regard. Really important stuff.
That's a fascinating overview. I'm so reminded of Dr. Linus Pauling and the work on structure function he did all over the years, and his advocacy that if we would understand how these structure function relationships and molecules related one to the other, we would understand a lot of disease. It's ironic, isn't it, that Gattaschuk was actually one of Pauling's students and really had the concept that these disorders were related to a slow-reacting virus, when really we now start seeing maybe it's protein conformations that relates to some of these interesting neurological disorders. So it seems like Pauling maybe has come 360 in this whole process.
Not the first time that would have happened with him. On this very basic level in biology, information equals structure.
I'd just like to give you maybe a closing comment as to how you see, from your vantage of all these various disciplines, the future of medicine. Do you have optimism? Do you see things converging on a path that will lead to discoveries that we can only just dream about right now, or are you pessimistic? What's your perspective?
Optimistic in terms of the basic reductive science that's going to tell us about the underpinnings of a spectacular number of diseases with amazing insight. Pessimism in that this is, in a lot of ways, going to be mopping up the wave of diseases that have been being eliminated over the last century or so, the ones that have single bullet explanations. Pessimism in terms of us having the non-reductive approach to make sense of diseases that are multifactorial, highly individualistic, highly dependent on social setting, context, all of that. And this is going to demand a retreat from one of the backbones of Western science for centuries now, which is believing that reductionism is going to be the answer to everything. The current incarnation being get the human genome sequence, and that's going to be the answer. The notion, if you want to study something complex, you have to understand its constituent parts. And when you look at the really complex multifactorial diseases that get us now, heart disease, diabetes, neurodegenerative disorders, as opposed to yellow fever or dengue fever or anthrax, what we have are diseases that are not going to be resolvable at the level of their constituent parts, instead emergent features that are going to demand a very different type of science, and it's not one that either the scientists or the clinicians get particularly good training at. So pessimistic in that regard, we got to do some different education in that realm.
I really appreciate your thoughtful comments on every level, and I think it's given us guidance and some motivation to keep vigilant in how we're learning, keep our minds open, and be prepared for seeing the universe maybe in slightly different ways to help remediate some of the age-related disorders. I thank you, Dr. Sapolsky, very much for your time.
Thank you. Take care.
You do the same. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Once again, thanks so much to Dr. Sapolsky for that stunning discussion with us. And obviously, he also talked about inflammation as we were discussing on side one of this month's Functional Medicine Update. You probably all saw the New England Journal of Medicine paper that appeared in the issue, volume 342, page 836 in the year 2000, entitled C-reactive protein and other markers of inflammation in the prediction of cardiovascular disease, in this case, in women. Once again, it confirms what we've been saying for several years in Functional Medicine Update, that measuring a C-reactive protein improves the prognostic screening specificity of a cardiac screening program beyond that of just measuring lipids themselves, and identifies women at risk for cardiovascular events. This is actually a paper, once again, from Dr. Paul Ridker's laboratory and Charles Hennequin at the Harvard Med School and Cardiovascular Disease Prevention Unit. I find this very interesting because, again, we have not looked traditionally in medicine for inflammatory markers as risk factors for vascular disease, and now it's starting to come on the radar screen. Still, there is not a reimbursement protocol that allows reimbursement for this assessment, so this is a technology ahead of its reimbursement, which then leads to the question of what drives medicine. Is it technology and understanding of how to improve patients, or is it somebody who has been given an ICD-9 code book at a third-party reimbursement desk and trying to figure out whether that will be paid for or not? I think this is a politics and economics of medicine question that I won't get into this issue, but certainly it's interesting, particularly as we look at it, for instance, with the context of type 2 diabetes. You may recall the paper that appeared in Diabetes Care in June 1999 entitled Impaired Glucose Tolerance, Why Is It Not a Disease? And in that article, the author really asked why it is that we don't have a diagnostic code for impaired glucose tolerance, because you can only have something you can treat when you have a diagnostic code. Until you have a diagnostic code, it doesn't exist, even though people are dying of premature coronary mortality as a consequence of impaired glucose tolerance. So you have to close the loop and have a diagnosis before you'll see it as a medical doctor, this article implies. Going beyond inflammation and heart disease, certainly we also know about the folate B6-B12 connection, and this is the homocysteine connection to subclinical atherosclerosis. And it once again reminds me of how much we really owe to Dr. Kilmer McCulley for starting us down this road over 30 years ago and understanding the connection between hyperhomocysteemia and coronary atherosclerotic and vascular diseases and now other disorders, including Down syndrome and bone loss, arthritis, maybe even cancer, and dementia. In this paper that I'm now referring to, which is Lancet Volume 355, page 517 in the year 2000, it's a report of the homocysteine-lowering effect of folic acid plus B6 in healthy siblings of patients with premature atherosclerotic disease, and it was found to be associated with a decreased occurrence of abnormal exercise electrocardiography tests, which is consistent with a decreased risk based upon functional assessment, and that's the electrocardiography test, of the risk of coronary events. So this ties many things together that we've been describing. A functional test to evaluate an incipient later stage pathology risk, the use of a metabolic indicator that then is ameliorated in this gene uniqueness called hyperhomocysteemia by nutritional intervention at the level of need of that individual based upon their own genome, not somebody else's, the mythical recommended dietary allowance level, but the level of nutrients they need to promote proper metabolic function. This couples together so much of Roger Williams' concepts of biochemical individuality and Dr. Linus Pauling's concepts of molecular medicine, and really shows once again why Kilmer McCulley helped us to understand a very significant contributor to early stage premature modifiable risk to disease, modifiable by asking the right question and giving the right agent. We know that serum folate is also correlated with the severity of atrophy of the neocortex in Alzheimer's disease. This is a very fascinating study, and I think most of you are aware of this. This is the nun study that was done with elderly Catholic sisters who lived in one convent, ate from the same kitchen, and were highly comparable for a wide range of environmental and lifestyle factors. So the only thing that really differed was their genes, because all other variables were kept constant. You probably couldn't have a better laboratory for assessment than these individuals. And it was found that low serum folate in genetically susceptible nuns was strongly associated with atrophy of the cerebral cortex, taking us beyond just that of homocysteine associated with atherosclerosis and cerebrovascular disease, but now taking us even into a temporal sequence that's related to Alzheimer's dementia and to effects that we see as early stage dementia. This is a fairly powerful suggestion, isn't it? Again, fundamental mechanisms of understanding lead to broad potential outcomes, syndromes and symptoms. The whole functional somatic symptom article that I started this issue, does it start raising your questions about where medicine has been and where it's going? I certainly hope so. You know, Dr. David Deutsch, in his book called The Fabric of Reality, talked about as medicine evolved to become a true science, it would be able to predict from first principles the outcome of therapies before they are even tried. And we're moving in that direction by seeing unified approaches towards the amelioration of function based upon genomic uniqueness that then can modify the course of pathophysiology. The same is true with even conditions like Parkinson's disease that Dr. Sapolsky was referring to, a very eloquent article that recently appeared in Nature that describes the prospects for restorative and neuroprotective treatments in Parkinson's. I'd like to just point out to you that the language they use in this article is so familiar to those of you who are listeners to Functional Medicine Update. I mean, we're right on the cusp of where this change is occurring. They go on to say that the progressive nature of Parkinson's and the fact that neuronal degeneration in the substantia nigra is slow and protracted present opportunities for therapeutic intervention aimed at blocking or slowing down the degenerative process, the so-called neuroprotective therapy approach. Recent radioimaging and autopsy data indicate that there is a preclinical period of many years before symptoms occur, and that the rate of cell loss and decline of dopaminergic function in the striatum is likely to be in the order of 10% or less per year, with the disease progressing relatively more rapidly during the early phases than in the more advanced stages. Both PET and SPECT imaging seem to be able to detect a decline in striatal dopamine function before clinical symptoms occur. This is the functional period of decline before pathophysiology that we've been describing. The authors go on to say, the neurodegenerative process in Parkinson's is likely to involve a cascade of interrelated events, including oxidative stress, mitochondrial dysfunction, excitotoxicity, and excess formation of nitric oxide and superoxide that gives rise to peroxynitrite as a consequence of inflammatory changes and immune upregulation. Doesn't this sound familiar with what we've been saying throughout this issue? Therefore, it leads us to recognize that the prevention or the neuroprotection against Parkinson's may in part relate to things like antioxidants that help to prevent oxidative damage and apoptotic death of cells, or neurotrophic agents that Dr. Sapolsky talked about. The largest neuroprotective trial ever conducted to date is the DataTOP study, involved two putative antioxidant agents, vitamin E and deprenyl, which you know as seligline hydrochloride. Vitamin E had no significant effect at the doses used, but deprenyl slowed the early progression of symptoms and delayed the emergence of disability by the average of 9 months. However, being an MAO inhibitor, this drug had symptomatic effects on its own. Animal studies have suggested that neuroprotective effect is not dependent on MAOB, but rather on its anti-apoptotic effects of seligline, and therefore helps to protect against oxidative damage and cell signaling. So people are looking at different kinds of antioxidants, lipoic acid, NAC, glutathione precursors, and how they interrelate, as well as nitric oxide modulators. Similarly with exocytotoxicity, finding ways to reduce the NMDA excitation pathway or the glutamate excitation pathway. And then, as Dr. Sapolsky talked about, neurotropic and anti-apoptotic factors. Therefore, there seems to be an ever-emerging optimism about where neurochemical research and neurobiology is taking us into new ways of preventing, starting at the functional decline level, not just at the stage where you've lost 70 or 80% of the dopaminergic neurons, at which, at best, you maybe have a remediation of symptoms for a small period of time, but never get back to full function. We also know, as Dr. Sapolsky pointed out, that there's a correlation between elevated levels of amyloid beta peptide in the brain and cognitive decline, in which these twisted proteins, these amyloid ropes, are associated as aggregates with the damage seen in Alzheimer's disease. Levels of amyloid beta protein 40 and 42 were elevated early in dementia, and levels of both peptides were strongly correlated with cognitive decline. In the frontal cortex, A-beta amyloid was elevated before the occurrence of the onset of serious symptoms. They go on to say these results support an important role in A-beta amyloid in mediating initial pathogenic events in Alzheimer's dementia and suggest that treatment strategies targeting the formation, accumulation, or cytotoxic effects of the A-beta amyloid should be pursued. This gives us, again, a functional measure well before the onset of pathology. The whole thrust of medical research appears to be moving at this early precursor marker form of functional declines and pathophysiological changes that occur at the cellular level well before the onset of gross pathology. One of the things that Dr. Sapolsky talked about in his brilliant elocution was the role that environmental enrichment plays as a neuroprotective agent. I find it fascinating. Recently, in Volume 1 of the new journal, the new ACHEM journal, Clinical Practice of Alternative Medicine, edited by Dr. Derek Lonsdale, an original paper was published entitled The Developmental Profile, a Quantitative Measure of Neurologic Development in Brain-Injured and Normal Children, co-authored by principal author Dr. Glenn Doman, Dr. Edward Lewin, Ralph Beligra, Mihai Cescu, and Rosalise Wilkinson from the Institutes for the Achievement of Human Potential in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. This is a very powerful paper in which they showed that by some use of assessment protocol that's been developed over 40 years plus at the institutes in evaluating neurological performance in children and in employing an environmental enrichment using improved exercise performance, musculoskeletal patterning, dietary intervention, and intellectual enrichment, that these children could gain back tremendous neurological function. Dendritic branching could be improved, and their cognitive and physical function could be remarkably improved. And with some of these kids, it looked like they were seriously injured, and maybe irreversibly, because of our thought that the brain can't repair, does repair, and they do function at high levels. In fact, years later, these kids might look as more than normal. They may look super normal. They may be performing at high levels. This is so optimistic because it, again, takes us away from the deterministic view of the body that once injured, it can't repair, and that the brain and nervous system is irreversible if injured, and that we have no control. And in fact, you probably should view the gut as also a part of the nervous system. The enteric nervous system of the gut contains as many neurons as the spinal cord, and many chemical messengers that regulate feeding by the brain have similar functions in the gut. We now recognize that this whole gut-brain connection and its interrelationship to intestinal motility, intestinal permeability, autointoxication, and enterotoxinemia all relate in part to, again, the cell signaling message to the microglia, the brain's immune system, and how that may translate to apoptotic cell death and neurological injury. The environment plays a significant role, both the external environment and the interior environment, the enteric bacterial environment. This is the emerging view that we're getting as to where functional medicine is taking us in the year 2000. Exciting new opportunities for both prevention and treatment that emerge from this. Thanks for being with us in July. We look forward to seeing you, hopefully during your summer vacation, August.
Functional Medicine Update is copyrighted by the Institute for Functional Medicine, Incorporated, located in Gig Harbor, Washington, USA. Reproduction in any form is prohibited.